WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Paul Robeson, the son of an ex-slave, became an All-American athlete and a star of the stage, screen, and concert hall. But Robeson never interpreted his success as a sign that discrimination against blacks was easing. Robeson's biographer writes, from 1940 to 1960, Robeson evolved fully from an artist with a conscience to an artist committed to political action. The more white America failed in the post-World War II years to stand up for the rights of people of color, the more Robeson grew into a militant spokesman for the world's oppressed. Robeson's stand endeared him to those who shared his politics, but cost him dearly with the multitude of mainstream Americans who had once been among his admirers. Robeson's support of Soviet communism made him the subject of suspicion in America. He was kept under surveillance by the FBI, and the State Department denied him a passport during the McCarthy era. He was blacklisted in America. Robeson died in 1976 after more than a decade of broken mental and physical health and two suicide attempts. The author of the new biography of Paul Robeson is my guest, Martin Baumel Duberman. Duberman is a historian, playwright, a gay rights activist, and a distinguished professor of history at the City University of New York. Duberman was chosen by Paul Robeson's son to write his father's biography. I asked how that came about.
The way it's told to me, both by Paul and by my agent, who was then his as well, Francis Golden, was that they had been working together trying to find an appropriate biographer, and Paul had not come up with a choice that pleased him. And then one day when he was in Fran's office, he happened to see my books on the shelf and started to browse and liked what he was reading and took some of them home and said to Fran, you know, I think we've found him. And he never specified to me precisely what qualities he found in my writing that he thought were appropriate or perhaps even in my life. But we met soon after that, and within a half hour, we had concluded. I told him that what I would require, I said I was thrilled at being invited to do the book, that I'd always admired Paul Robeson, and I was also deeply flattered because I'm white. He was prepared to offer me exclusive access to the archives, which had been closed previously to all professional scholars. And I told him one more thing that I would require would be a formal legal agreement that he gave up all control over whatever it was that I finally decided to put into the book. And he agreed to that, and so we were off.
I think a lot of people were surprised that Paul Robeson Jr. chose a white historian to write the biography of his father. Where do you stand on that? Do you think that it matters if a person's white or black, if they're writing black history or the biography of a black figure?
I think it all hinges on... I mean, the question is really a question, can anybody who does not exactly duplicate another person's life successfully write about them? That would mean, can a man write about a woman? Can an older person write about a younger person? Can a straight person write about a gay person, etc.? I think the points of identification that make for success are very individual. Because of certain experience of my own, I think, at least in comparison with other professional historians, I have some unusual qualifications for taking on the biography. For example, I've been active in left politics. I've had a career in the theater, both mostly as a playwright, but to some minor extent as an actor. And beyond all of that, I think, I too have been, in a way, a spy in the culture, just as Robeson was, though on a different level. I mean, I'm a gay man who has always, quote, passed in straight society. I've never had any trouble, you know, getting good jobs, getting ahead in my career and so forth. And yet I always felt like I was an outsider who had been let inside. And I think something of that same psychological mechanism was operating in Robeson. I mean, he was a black man who had been allowed in, but always knew that he never entirely belonged and always was evaluating the culture even while he was participating in it.
One of the things you did when you were researching the book was to file under the Freedom of Information Act to get Robeson's FBI files, and eventually you sued the FBI. Why did you sue them?
I sued them because under Reagan, FOIA is a joke. No scholar, regardless of his or her subject, can in fact get much material under FOIA any longer. And yet I felt it was urgent to get that material because rumors have been floating around for many years that various agencies of our government, but especially the FBI, were complicitous in the decline of Robeson's health, as of course they were complicitous in the decline of his public reputation. When I originally applied under FOIA, I was sent some material for the early 1940s, but basically I was sent large box after large box of essentially inked out pages. And I realized the only hope of getting what could be crucial data was to sue. And I found a good radical lawyer, Ed Greer in Boston, who has a lot of experience with FOIA, and so we went to court. It took, we were in court about 3 years. At a cost of something like $20,000. And by that point, we were nearing the completion of the manuscript. And Ed said to me, look, the FBI has a battery of lawyers. They can fight this through all kinds of appeals. Your book's nearly done. Even if we win at the final level of appeal, you'll get the information too late to use in the book. And so Ed suggested a formal negotiation. In fact, I think the FBI suggested it, and we finally agreed to it. In other words, they let me have brief descriptions of something like 15 or 20 key documents. At least they said they were key. God knows what they weren't giving me to choose from. And on the basis of those brief descriptions, I made my choices. I think I got like 8 or 10. They were almost all disappointing. The brief descriptions were inflations, in fact, of the actual contents of the documents. So it ended up being very disappointing. Probably the most disastrous thing that happened as a result of the litigation was that one day one of the FBI lawyers with a real smirk on his face said to Ed Greer, isn't it funny, he said, we started with, and here I forget the exact numbers, I think, We started with 105 or 6 volumes of files on Robeson's, and now, for some strange reason, 56 of them have disappeared. Ha ha. In other words, if there was damaging material in the FBI files, that material, as a result of my lawsuit, alas, has now been destroyed. So we may never know the full truth about the government's involvement in Robeson's physical decline.
Can you sum up for us what you did learn about the FBI's surveillance of Robeson and any possible harassment?
Well, there's no doubt, the material is voluminous, that the FBI and other agencies harassed Robeson relentlessly. They followed him, a New York agent followed him on what may well have been a near daily basis. His mail was opened, his phone was tapped, not his own phone, but his conversations with others. I think the extent and the duration of this harassment does go some way to explaining Robeson's emotional breakdown. As one of his psychiatrists said to me, what's surprising is not that Robeson eventually broke down, but that Robeson did not break down earlier as a result of this kind of intense scrutiny and harassment.
Several reviewers of your biography of Paul Robeson have mentioned that they thought that you didn't spend enough time talking about Robeson's reaction to the Stalinist revelations, the revelations about the purges. Robeson had although he was never a member of the Communist Party in America, he was very sympathetic to the Soviet revolution and visited the Soviet Union often and sympathized with communism. What's your response? And how much did you find out about his response to the Soviet purges?
Mm-hmm. Well, the major problem in the biography in general, but specifically in terms of this question, is that Robeson left very few personal traces, meaning he kept no diary, except for very few shorthand notes once in a while. And throughout his life, he wrote very few letters. It's as if he deliberately decided he did not wish to be tracked, either then or retrospectively. So it's been very hard to reconstruct anything about his inner life. And on an issue like Stalin's crimes, Paul Robeson Jr. said to me he was in the room when his father read the New York Times, which carried Khrushchev's speech, and his father put the newspaper down after reading it and never said one word, either at the time or ever after. And other of Robeson's intimate friends, who I've interviewed in depth, have confirmed it. He never spoke, even in private, in other words, even to his intimates. The way I've interpreted that silence is that, you know, his great heart was almost certainly, you know, profoundly disturbed and unhappy at those revelations, but he did not wish himself to become an obstacle to socialism. He hoped that the Soviet experiment would eventually right itself, and that the crimes of a single leader, Joseph Stalin, did not destroy the potential of that experiment. So he chose silence. He did not wish to feed the propaganda mill. He did not wish to lend any support to the right-wing bigots who currently control, that is, in the 1950s, the American government.
Do you think too much attention is being paid to his response to Stalinism?
Absolutely. I think, in a way, it's shocking the way some of the white reviewers, never the black ones, are getting fixated on this single issue. And I think the reason is they rather continue Cold War rhetoric and continue to red-bait Robeson than deal with the totality of his life, than deal, for example, with his deep compassion for the oppressed, his militant insistence on the rights of his own people for full freedom, and his daring to question whether or not it might not be the greed and the competitive zeal engendered by the capitalist ethic, which accounts for the needless amount of suffering everywhere in the world.
Did you feel a tension in any of his performances of giving his best performance possible, but also being pulled into playing certain stereotypic roles?
I think all of his roles were stereotypes. I think nonetheless he broke through the stereotypes in many of his performances simply because of the charisma and the dignity of the personality. So that even if he was playing some absurdist version of an African chief, just the strength and integrity of the personality shone through on the screen.
You say that he retired from movies because he thought the situation with stereotyping was hopeless, and he felt that the only solution to big-budget stereotyping was for the federal government to create standards of honest treatment and for filmmakers to make low-budget films that wouldn't be reliant on the South for profits. What do you think have liked to stay in movies and in a performing career if it weren't for stereotyping? Or do you think he was more interested in a kind of more politically oriented career anyways?
I think he would have hoped not to be forced to make that choice. I mean, after all, he quit movies in 1942, and it's only roughly a year and a half later that he performs Othello on Broadway. Mm-hmm. I think he would have been pleased if additional roles were offered to him. I mean, that is roles that represented something other than the stereotype. I think he would have been happy to perform them. He just wasn't offered those roles.
An interesting contradiction that I thought was brought up in your book was how Robeson really didn't like jazz, especially in the 20s and 30s, though he came to enjoy it more later on. Mm-hmm. And you said if you took Ellington's rhythms and compared it to real African music, that Ellington's rhythms sounded childish. What I thought was the contradiction was that in his own concert career, the spirituals he sang had such a kind of European concert type of flavor to them.
Well, that's the exact criticism in his own day that was leveled by Zora Neale Hurston. She felt that Robeson did represent the European tradition. She thought he did better in that tradition than anybody else. But she felt that the spirituals and the work songs were folk material and needed to be sung and perhaps not even performed, but sung by a collective group rather than by a soloist. So yes, that criticism was leveled in Robeson's own day. On the other hand, you know, the unique warmth and vibrance of that voice, the deep emotionality of the voice, I think do create and convey the essential strength and poignancy of that music.
Robeson's story, the way you tell it, is really both tragedy and triumph. He had so many remarkable accomplishments, yet he was shut out of so much. He was harassed. He was condemned. He wasn't allowed to perform where he wanted to. So it's really this double-edged story.
Very much so. Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the saddest aspects of it is that he was even shut out by the black establishment. In those years, as Bayard Rustin said to me, I mean, the black leadership felt, realistically or not, that it was far more beholden to the white powers that be for favors. And so once Robeson got doubly labeled, that is, black and red, the black establishment felt that it could it would only jeopardize its own standing if it continued to accept or associate with Robeson. But as Bayard Rustin also said to me, that doesn't mean that what the black leadership said publicly about Robeson, and they did troop to the microphones in order to denounce him, was the same as what they felt privately about him. They certainly recognized, at the very least, that Robeson, through his militant insistence on full freedom, made their more moderate partial demands more palatable to the white powers that be.
You seem to be a historian who, over the years, has really struggled with the value of history and its relevance to the present. And I think there have been periods of your career as a historian where you've really been thrown into a crisis over the relevance of history. And I was wondering what first precipitated that crisis.
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, to the extent I understand my own, you know, inner process, I think I wanted history to problem solve. I was myself getting increasingly active in the 60s, politically active, and I wanted some, you know, relevant information from the past that would help me and others to come up with solutions for some of the issues that were bothering us in the present. I finally concluded that in that kind of, you know, specific, concrete way, the past could never offer anything like blueprints or solutions. What it could offer is, you know, a roughly analogous situation in which people in the past have tried to cope with a roughly analogous problem. So after going through a rather stormy period in which I doubted that history was worth anything, I've since come back to believe that it's worth quite a bit.
You have a collection of your essays on history, and one of them is about your realization that although you had spent so much time studying history, you knew very, very little about your own family history, and that your father, who was from the Soviet Union, had really never told you much about anything about life in the Soviet Union. Why did that start to affect you, the absence of a personal family history?
It was just a general sense I had that somehow to study history professionally was a way of compensating for my own lack of personal memory. I'm not even sure that I'm right in that. I may have invented that connection, but at the time I felt it strongly. I don't understand why it is that I have such a bad memory myself as an individual. I once described it as having a kind of large eraser hanging down my back, and as I took steps forward, the eraser automatically made all my footsteps disappear.
It seems that a turning point for you is when you started writing gay history, that all your questions about the relevance of history were perhaps answered in part when you started writing about gay history, because it was such a personally significant subject for you.
Only in part. Once again, I mean, when historians began, it's only about 15 years ago, to try to discover a gay and lesbian past, I think the general hope was that if we looked back, we would find people who were more or less replicas of ourselves. That has turned out not to be the case, and this is, you know, an elaborate conclusion, which I'll try not to go into in any detail here, but like everything else about human nature, homosexuality took on very different shapes and forms in the past than it does today. And so, once again, we can't find, you know, any exact replicas or duplications of ourselves.
But on the other hand, you're learning something about the truth of the gay and lesbian past. I think so many stereotypes and myths are based on this false sense of history.
Yeah, I think what we learn is something more general. What we learn, if we study people in the past who were different, and this means gender nonconformists of all kinds, they don't have to specifically have a gay sexual orientation, but if we study people who were different, we learn something about, you know, how they coped with the forces of oppression that were brought to bear on them. And indeed, those forces have always been brought to bear on nonconformists in the United States, because we are such a deeply conformist country. And in learning about those strategies and in learning about the determination of people in the past to, you know, insist that they be treated respectfully, I think we learn a lot about ourselves and our own resources for coping in the present.
You have published excerpts of your own journal, which is a kind of personal history, and you talk a lot about the pressure to conform and all the therapy that you were in, with doctors telling you that you should really change your ways, that it was sick to be a homosexual. Were there like particular therapy plans that were prescribed for you to convert?
Ah, you want to dredge up those terrible years. Okay. I mean, in a way, you could say I wasn't subjected, you know, to the worst of those therapies. I mean, there was a period, not so long ago, alas, in which the behaviorists used to place their gay male patients on electric grids and then flash pictures of naked men on the wall and shock the patient. I, as I say, was not subjected to that kind of barbarity. But I was told, you know, year after year in both individual and group therapy that I was suffering from a basic character disorder, that I was deeply disturbed, that I had no chance for a happy, satisfying life unless I devoted myself to conversion, to becoming a bona fide heterosexual. And indeed, sad to relate, I so devoted myself for many years. Because when you grew up gay in the 40s and the 50s, the homophobia was so overwhelming and so intense that almost inevitably you did internalize it. You did come to think just as badly of yourself as the society wanted you to. And therefore you followed, you know, the social cues, and you presented yourself for therapy, and you tried to make yourself over into a more acceptable kind of human being. The therapist that I was with during most of the 60s announced that I was the only homosexual that he had never cured. And that was because, as he put it, I was the single most defiant personality he had ever met. To which I can only say in retrospect, thank God for my defiance.
Does that stuff stick with you even when you start to realize this is ridiculous? Did the results of those attempts to convert you stay with you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there'll always be a residue within me of, you know, self-contempt. I may have gotten off better than most of my generation. I mean, after all, there are very few people of my generation, that is men over or women over the age of 45, whoever come out. I mean, they don't feel entitled still to that kind of standing up for themselves. I mean, declaring the rightness of their lives. And that's because, you know, they too ingested this homophobia with their pablum. You don't get rid of those, you know, formative impressions about yourself just by wanting to. Yeah, I think the whole generation is deeply scarred, certainly myself included.
You've written so many different kinds of history, from plays to straightforward history to essays on the writing of history to personal biography, to, personal autobiography to biography of others. Your latest book is the Paul Robeson book. You had gone through a crisis earlier in your career about the relevance of history to the present. Has writing the biography of Paul Robeson affected you in terms of thinking about the relevance of history and the relevance of biography?
Well, in the Robeson book, I've returned to a very traditional format. I'm not attempting any of the fancy interventions and the subjective musings which I did attempt in one of my books, A History of Black Mountain College. I think just being put in touch with Robeson's life in detail, I mean, it's the texture of the detail that I think is so informative. I don't know, one has to use an old-fashioned word, at least I do. I mean, I think it's inspiring to learn about a life like Robeson's, which in which he gave up privilege. He was sitting in the lap of luxury. He was on top of the world in the 1930s. He gave it up, fully recognizing what the consequences were likely to be, in order to speak out, and speak out militantly, in defense of those who had been less privileged and were perhaps less gifted than he. I think that's a noble and an inspiring story, and yes, does make me think that history, once again, has some relevance.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been...